A holiday means so much more when you understand the history behind it. Whether it's Memorial Day or Independence Day or Thanksgiving or any other of our national holidays, once you realize how that holiday came into existence and why it's celebrated, it means so much more. The same is true when it comes to Jewish holidays. They mean more when you understand the history behind them. So I want to read a portion of the book of Esther this morning to introduce you to one of the Jewish holidays that we don't often think of. So open to Esther chapter 9. If you're wondering where Esther is, it comes after Ezra and Nehemiah. Whether that helps or not, I'm not sure. But that is where you'll find it. Esther. Esther chapter 9 and verse 20. And Mordecai recorded these things and sent letters to all the Jews who were in all the provinces of King Ahasuerus, both near and far, obliging them to keep the 14th day of the month Adar and also the 15th day of the same year by year as the days on which the Jews got relief from their enemies and as the month that had been turned for them from sorrow into gladness and from mourning into a holiday, that they should make them days of feasting and gladness, days for sending gifts of food to one another and gifts to the poor. So the Jews accepted what they had started to do and what Mordecai had written to them. For Haman the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, the enemy of all the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to destroy them and had cast pur, that is, cast lots, to crush and destroy them. But when it came before the king, he gave orders in writing that his evil plan that he had devised against the Jews should return on his own head, and that he and his sons should be hanged on the gallows. Therefore they called these days Purim, after the term pure. Therefore, because of all that was written in this letter, and of what they had faced in this matter, and of what had happened to them, the Jews firmly obligated themselves and their offspring and all who joined them that without fail they would keep these 2 days according to what was written and at the time appointed every year, that these days should be remembered and kept throughout every generation, in every clan, province, and city, and that these days of Purim should never fall into disuse among the Jews, nor should the commemoration of these days cease among their descendants. Then Queen Esther, the daughter of Abihail, and Mordecai the Jew gave full written authority, confirming this second letter about Purim. Letters were sent to all the Jews, to the 127 provinces of the kingdom of Ahasuerus in words of peace and truth, that these days of Purim should be observed at their appointed seasons as Mordecai the Jew and Queen Esther obligated them and as they had obligated themselves and their offspring with regard to their fasts and their lamenting. The command of Queen Esther confirmed these practices of Purim, and it was recorded in writing. This is the Feast of Purim, instituted at the end of the book of Esther. As you noticed in the text, that Purim literally means lots. It comes from the word pur and gets its name from the way the wicked Haman had cast lots to determine on what day the Jewish race ought to be annihilated. The Feast of Purim commemorates the saving of the Jewish people, which is not the first time. It's not the first time that Satan in biblical history has sought to destroy the the Jewish people, and it's not the first time that God has saved them. That's really what's behind the book of Esther. There's a war. There's a spiritual war going on between Satan and God. You remember in the book of Genesis when God cursed the serpent in the garden, he promised that the seed of the woman would one day come to crush his head. And so since then, Satan has been doing everything in his power to sever the human line that would fulfill that promise. Through murder, through rebellion, through famine and slavery, through the divided kingdom, through Saul's attempts to murder David, through Joseph's brothers and their hatred for him, and on it goes. The redemption story in the book of Esther is similar to the true story of God saving Israel through the ministry of Joseph, through his suffering, through his elevation to a place of prominent political leadership. But the book of Esther is very different than the story of Joseph in that God's involvement is kept hidden in the darkness. His involvement is hidden in the shadows, in the background. And that's what makes the book of Esther so unique. It's the only book of the Bible where God's name is not mentioned. There's simply no acknowledgement of his presence in an upfront way, and yet his sovereignty and his providence is revealed on every page. Even a casual reading of it reveals that there's no such thing as a coincidence. There's no such thing as chance. Instead, there is the invisible hand of God guiding by his providence. The book's events silently support the claims of other scripture that God is sovereign and he is directing all things toward the fulfillment of his plan. Now, the events of the book of Esther take place at the time of the Jewish exile, but in the kingdom of Persia. I want you to see this morning the invisible hand of God revealed in the book of Esther. And I want you to notice how God's hand of providence governs four areas of our lives. Number one, the invisible hand of God's providence governs the demotion and elevation of political leaders. Chapter 1, the opening scene of this drama takes place in the palace of the king of Persia. Verse 1 says, "Now in the days of Ahasuerus," the Ahasuerus who reigned from India to Ethiopia over 127 provinces, "in those days when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in Susa, the citadel, in the third year of his reign, he gave a feast for all his officials and servants." So Ahasuerus, or Xerxes I, he's also known as, he decides to give a banquet for all of his officials and his servants, but this was not your average party. It lasted 6 months long, and the guests received an unlimited supply of wine. This six-month feast for the king's servants is then followed by a seven-day feast for all who lived in the city of Susa, the capital of Persia. And on top of the king's feast, the queen also gives a feast. We see that in verse 9. Queen Vashti also gave a feast for the women in the palace that belonged to King Ahasuerus. But then trouble enters the picture. Verse 10, "On the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry with wine, he commanded," I don't know, maybe Mahuman, maybe Mahuman, maybe Mahuman, Bizda, Harbona, Bigtha, "you pregnant ladies should just close your ears, don't get any ideas from these names, Zethar and Carcass. The seven eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown in order to show the peoples and the princes her beauty, for she was lovely to look at. So the king wants to show off the beauty of his queen. But Queen Vashti refused to come at the king's command, delivered by the eunuchs. At this, the king became enraged, and his anger burned within him. The beautiful Queen Vashti refuses the drunken king's request, and now there is trouble. She rebels. She refuses to come at his command. And so the king has a real problem on his hands. What is he to do? The king's wise men then enter the picture, and they say, well, that if he does nothing, then all the women of the kingdom will also be disrespectful toward their husbands. And so the king issues a decree stating that Queen Vashti is forever to be deposed, and that every man should be the head of his house. So that's what happens. Vashti is demoted, and now a new queen must be found. And so the king's young men encourage him to host a beauty pageant to find Miss Persia. And we find this recorded in chapter 2 and verse 3. And let the king appoint officers in all the provinces of his kingdom to gather all the beautiful young virgins to the harem in Susa, the citadel, under custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women. Let their cosmetics be given them, and let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. This pleased the king, and he did so. And so now enters onto the stage Esther, the heroine of the book. Verse 5, now there was a Jew in Susa, the citadel, whose name was Mordecai, the son of Jair, son of Shimei, son of Kish, a Benjamite, who had been carried away from Jerusalem among the captives, carried away with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, had carried away. He was bringing up Hadassah, that is Esther. Hadassah is her Hebrew name. It means myrtle tree. The daughter of his uncle, for she had neither father nor mother. The young woman had a beautiful figure and was lovely to look at. And when her father and her mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. So when the king's order and his edict were proclaimed, and when many young women were gathered in Susa, the citadel, in custody of Haggai, Esther also was taken into the king's palace and put in custody of this man who had the charge of the women. And the young woman pleased him and won his favor, and he quickly provided her with cosmetics and her portion of food, and with seven chosen young women from the king's palace, and advanced her and her young women to the best place in the harem. And as somewhat of a parenthesis, verse 10 lets us know that Esther has not yet made known her people or kindred, for Mordecai had commanded her not to make it known. So she kept the fact that she was Jewish a secret. And so out of these women, Esther is selected. She is given seven personal attendants, because even though she is one of the most beautiful women in the kingdom, she still needs 12 months of cosmetics. This is Mary Kay on steroids. I'm pretty sure Botox was invented in Persia. But after a year at the spa, Esther goes to the harem's closet. She gets to choose any clothing she wants, whatever jewelry she wants, to prepare herself to meet the king, to present herself to the king. And so we pick it up in verse 16 of chapter 2, when it says, And when Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus into his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month of Tebeth in the 7th year of his reign, the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she won grace and favor in his sight more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. So Esther is now the queen of Persia. Vashti has been demoted. Esther has been promoted, elevated to that position. And it's no small coincidence that she's Jewish. And this is the first way we see the invisible hand of God's providence in the book of Esther. We see how God governs over the demotion of leaders and the elevation of leaders. So, is there application in this for us? Well, there's a whole lot of application. For example, if you tend to lose sleep over the state of current affairs or get anxious about upcoming elections, then rest assured, God is in control. Though he works in and through his people and processes, the end results are his. For example, Proverbs 16:33 says, "The lot is cast into the lap, but its every decision is from the Lord." The votes are cast on Tuesday, and the end result is the decision of the Lord. Daniel 2:21 says, "He changes times and seasons. He removes kings, and he sets up kings." Or Psalm 66, verse 7, God rules by his might forever. His eyes keep watch on all the nations. Let not the rebellious exalt themselves. And so the invisible hand of God governs over the affairs of the world, demoting some leaders and raising up others as part of his plan. There's a second way we see the invisible hand of providence, and that is that God governs over the timing of seemingly insignificant events. Pick it up in chapter 2, verse 19. "Now when the virgins were gathered together the second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Esther had not yet made known her kindred or her people, as Mordecai had commanded her, for Esther obeyed Mordecai just as when she was brought up by him. In those days, as Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthan and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs who guarded the threshold, became angry and sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. And this came to the knowledge of Mordecai, and he told it to Queen Esther, and Esther told the king in the name of Mordecai. When the affair was investigated and found to be so, the men were both hanged on the gallows, and it was recorded in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king." And so Esther's older cousin and father figure saves the king's life by thwarting an assassination attempt, but all is forgotten. And Mordecai goes back into the shadows. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the Agagite, the son of Hammedatha, and advanced him and set his throne above all the officials who were with him. And so now enters Haman, the antagonist in this drama. He is an Agagite, that is, he's a descendant of King Agag, who Saul was commanded to kill in 1 Samuel 15, but didn't. And all the king's servants who were at the king's gate bowed down and paid homage to Haman, for the king had so commanded concerning him. But Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage. Then the king's servants who were at the king's gate said to Mordecai, "Why do you transgress the king's command?" And when they spoke to him day after day and he would not listen to them, they told Haman in order to see whether Mordecai's words would stand, for he had told them that he was a Jew. And when Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow down or pay homage to him, Haman was filled with fury. And so here's Haman, who hates Mordecai because Mordecai refuses to bow down to him. And when he finds out that Mordecai is a Jew, his hatred goes beyond Mordecai to his entire kinship. See, before Hitler, there was Haman. Filled with fury against Mordecai, Haman plots now to kill every Jew. And chapter 3 then goes on to reveal him plotting. And all of this takes place 4 years after Esther has become queen. And so she's been on the throne for a little, but still her identity is unknown. And so basically Haman's plan consists of presenting the Jews as a rebellious group who is a threat to the king, and he offers 10,000 talents of silver to the king if he will agree to let him do whatever he wants to the Jews. The king refuses the bribe, but he gives him the authority. He gives him his signet ring, which was the ring of the king. It was the ring that was used to make a stamp, an impression in soft clay on an official government document. And so Haman now had the power and authority of the king to kill the Jews. And so he sends letters to all the provinces in the kingdom, informing them that on the 13th day of the 12th month, or on March 13th, all the Jews should be slaughtered on one day. And Mordecai hears of the demonic news, and he goes into mourning. And so in chapter 4, we see Mordecai weeping in sackcloth and ashes at the king's gate. And Esther's maids see him and go back to the queen and report what's going on. And now the queen is in a predicament. Even though she is the queen, Esther cannot simply waltz into the king's presence. She just can't do that. She must wait until she is summoned by the king to go into the king's presence uninvited would result in her losing her pretty little head. That was the punishment. But Mordecai challenges her to think about why she has been put in this position. And he speaks then the key verses in the book. For if you keep silent at this time, he says, relief and deliverance will rise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Listen, and then Mordecai says this to Esther, and who knows whether you have not come to the kingdom for such a time as this, as verse 14 of chapter 4. Who knows, Esther, if you have not been placed into this position as the queen, as a Jew in Persia, for such a time as this? See the invisible hand of God weaving together all of these seemingly unrelated, insignificant events. He's setting the stage, as he was with Joseph, in sending Joseph to Egypt ahead of his brothers and his father. So God is setting the stage by placing Esther in the kingdom in order to save his people. So Esther then tells Mordecai to assemble all of the Jews to proclaim a 3-day fast for her And now she is going to risk her life by talking to the king. And chapter 5 describes that meeting. The king sees Esther in the courts, and he holds out his scepter, which is him saying she now has permission to come into his presence. And so she makes a very simple request. She says, "Can you and Haman come to a feast, to a banquet that I'm putting on today?" And at the banquet, King Ahasuerus grants her another request, and she therefore then asks for them to return the next day. And this is the happiest day in Haman's life. To be honored along with the king. But his joy quickly dissipates as he leaves the palace. He sees Mordecai, who still refuses to bow to him. And so he goes home deflated and angry in chapter 5 and verse 9. Says, "And Haman went out that day joyful and glad of heart, but when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he neither rose nor trembled before him, he was filled with wrath against Mordecai. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home, and he sent and brought his friends and his wife Zeresh, and Haman recounted to them the splendor of his riches, the number of his sons, all the promotions with which the king had honored him, and how he had advanced him above the officials and the servants of the king. Then Haman said, 'Even Queen Esther, let no one but me come with the king to the feast she prepared. And tomorrow also I am invited by her together with the king. Yet all this is worth nothing to me so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate.' And his wife Zeresh and all his friends said to him, 'Let a gallows 50 cubits high be made, and in the morning tell the king to have Mordecai hanged upon it. Then go joyfully with the king to the feast.' This idea pleased Haman, and he had the gallows made." And all of these events seem insignificant and seem unrelated until you get to chapter 6, where we then see the third act in this drama, which is God's invisible hand of providence also governs over the reward of the righteous and the punishment of the wicked. And on that night, the king could not sleep. Oh, it just happened by chance, of course. It just happened by coincidence that this is the night that the king should have insomnia. And he can't sleep, and so he does what a lot of us should do when we can't sleep. We should read. And so he gives orders to bring the Book of Memorable Deeds, the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it was found written how Mordecai had told about Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, and who guarded the threshold and who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus. So it just happens that this night the king can't sleep. It just so happens, he says, "Would you read to me?" It just so happens that the book opens to the account of Mordecai saving the king. And the king says, "What honor or distinction has been bestowed on Mordecai for this?" The king's young men who attended him said, "Nothing has been done for him." And the king said, "Who is in the court?" Now Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to speak to the king about having Mordecai hanged on the gallows that he had prepared for him. Before Haman can even get a word out, the king says, "Haman, tell me, what would you do if you wanted to honor someone?" And Haman immediately thinks, oh, filled with arrogance, you know, what would he want? Of course, because of course the king is talking about him. And so he says, "Well, I would take him and I would put a royal robe on him and I would seat him on a royal horse and I would parade him up and down the streets. I'd put the crown on his head and I would proclaim, 'Thus it shall be done to the man whom the king desires to honor.'" And the king says, "Excellent." Do it to Mordecai. And we pick it up in chapter 6, verse 11. So Haman took the robes and the horse, and he dressed Mordecai. Can you imagine how difficult this was for him? And led him through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, "Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor." Then Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman hurried to his house, mourning and with his head covered. And Haman told his wife Zeresh and all his friends everything that had happened to him. Then his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, "If Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him." Isn't that interesting? The testimony of God throughout the history of the world up to that point has been known, even in the pagan nations, that God takes care of his people. While they were yet talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried to bring Haman to the feast that Esther had prepared. It's just been a really awful day for Haman. But at least he gets to go to the banquet. At least he gets to go to the second banquet that Esther has planned. And so at the banquet, the king asks Esther, "What is your wish, Queen Esther? It shall be granted you. And what is your request? Even to half of the kingdom, it shall be yours." So Esther reveals the wicked plot against her people, the Jews, and she reveals her identity now for the first time. Chapter 7, verse 5, "Then King Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther, 'Who is he? And where is he? Who is the man who dares to wipe out your people?' And Esther said, 'A foe and enemy, this wicked Haman.' Then Haman was terrified before the king and the queen. The king arose in his wrath," verse 7. The king is so angry. He gets up, he leaves the room, he goes into the palace garden. He has to blow off some steam, and Haman stays there with the queen and begs for his life, it says in verse 7. "For he saw that harm was determined against him by the king. And the king returned from the palace garden to the place where they were drinking wine. As Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was, pleading with her, on his knees begging. And the king said, 'Will he even assault the queen in my presence, in my very own house?' As the word left the mouth of the king, they covered Haman's face. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs in attendance on the king, said, 'Moreover, the gallows that Haman has prepared for Mordecai, whose word saved the king, is standing at Haman's house, 50 cubits high.' And the king said, 'Hang him on that.' So they hanged Haman on the gallows that he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the wrath of the king abated." You know, Proverbs says, 29:6, "Evil people fall into their own traps." Here it is. The very gallows, 75 feet high, that he had built to hang Mordecai were used to hang himself. Is there any application in that for us? There's a lot of application there. You know, sometimes our minds and our hearts struggle with the seeming inequity of judgment in our world, doesn't it? The righteous are punished and the wicked get away with murder. Even King Solomon struggled with this. At the end of the book of Ecclesiastes, he wrote, "The end of the matter, all has been heard, is this: fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God will bring every deed into judgment and every secret thing, whether good or evil." So remember, when you struggle with that sense of injustice, remember that God will get the final word. God always gets the final word. And when King Jesus returns, he will be the judge of all. His invisible hand is at work now, punishing the wicked, rewarding the righteous, but there is a day coming, a final day of judgment yet to come. Remember that. And after that final judgment day, those who know the Lord will be forever delivered from the presence of evil. The Apostle John describes the heavenly city this way in the end of Revelation: nothing evil will be allowed to enter, nor anyone who practices shameful idolatry or dishonesty, but only those whose names are written in the Lamb's book of life. God will get the final word. God will judge the wicked. And God will grant everlasting life to those whose names are written in the book of life, which is the Lamb's book of life, which means to get into that book, you have to know the Lamb of God, who is Jesus Christ, the promised Messiah. But there's a fourth and final way we see the invisible hand of God's providence in the book of Esther. We see this in this way, that God's hand of providence governs the reversal of Satan's evil plans against God's people. We see in chapter 8 and verse 1, "On that day King Ahasuerus gave to Queen Esther the house of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, and Mordecai came before the king, for Esther had told what he was to her. And the king took off his signet ring, which he had taken from Haman, and gave it to Mordecai, and Esther set Mordecai over the house of Haman." See the reversal? Haman is dead, and the king's signet ring is removed from Haman's cold finger and given to Mordecai. Mordecai now has authority as the second in command in the kingdom. But there's a problem, because there is still this edict for the Jews to be destroyed on March 13th. And the laws of the Medes and Persians says you can't change a law. No law can ever be changed. And so the king says to Mordecai, "All I can do is make a new law." And that's what they request. They request that the Jews would be able to fight for their lives. Another coincidence. The day of the battle occurs on the very same day as Haman's intended massacre. But instead of the Jews being killed, they defeat their enemies. A reversal. Esther makes one final request: let the Jews in the capital city be allowed to kill their enemies, and let Haman's 10 sons be hung on the gallows. And when all is said and done, Queen Esther then establishes this national holiday, the Feast of Purim, this two-day celebration to be held annually as a remembrance of God saving his people from the wicked plot of Haman. But before the final curtain closes on the drama, Mordecai is exalted in the kingdom, second only to the king. And so another attempt to annihilate the Jewish people has been thwarted. another satanic attempt to sever the human line that would produce the Messiah, has been thwarted by God. Reversed by God's victory, by the victory of his sovereignty. And in this way, the book of Esther is not only historical, it also is a prelude to the victorious work of Jesus Christ, who would conquer the evil one, who would be victorious over death and Satan. It's a precursor to the ultimate reversal of Satan's evil plans. See, what Satan means to destroy, God means to redeem and to restore. Know that. As a follower of Jesus Christ, if you love Christ and you're faithful to him and you love his gospel and you seek to serve him, Satan will despise you. He will seek to work against you. He will seek to attack you at every chance he gets. He will use whatever means he can employ to destroy you. But remember that what Satan means to destroy, God means to redeem. And what man plans for evil, God plans for good and for his glory. And the ultimate display of that is Jesus Christ the Messiah, crucified on the cross of Calvary by men and women who were taken up with hatred induced by the enemy, killed, crucified, and for 3 days the devil was one happy devil. But when Jesus rose from the grave, he knew his fate had been sealed. Because Jesus is the sovereign one. He is the victor. And that's why when Peter was preaching on the day of Pentecost and his words were convicting the very people responsible for murdering the Messiah, he said to them, "Men of Israel, listen to me. Jesus of Nazareth, a man attested to you by God with mighty works and wonders and signs that God did through him in your midst, as you yourselves know, this Jesus, delivered up according to the definite plan and foreknowledge of God, you crucified." He looks at the Jewish audience that he's preaching to, and he says, "God, through all the ages, promised he would send you his chosen one, his Messiah, your Messiah. And when he showed up, you murdered him." But even that was all part of the plan of God to defeat sin and Satan once and forever. So the triumph in the book of Esther points us to the greatest triumph of all, the triumph of Jesus over sin and death. So remember this. When you're confused or discouraged, when you fear the outcome of wicked politicians or enemies in your own life, when you doubt God's timing, when you struggle with seeing unbelievers prosper more than you, when Satan appears to be winning the war, remember the invisible hand of God is at work. Behind the scenes. But he will make his presence known at just the right time. He'll pull back the curtain and let you see. What an amazing God who is worthy of all of our worship. Trust him, will you? Trust him. Father, thank you. Thank you for exalting yourself through the book of Esther, even though your name is nowhere to be found. Thank you that hidden in the white space between all those lines of text is your invisible hand, your goodness, your sovereignty, your wisdom, all working together, putting together millions of moving parts, all toward one end, your glory, the uplifting of your Son, who your word says one day will be exalted and every knee shall bow and every tongue will confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. Oh God, thank you for the privilege of knowing him today and being able to exalt him today. Work in our hearts. Do whatever work the Holy Spirit knows needs to happen. For we are yours. And we humble ourselves before you and the great King, King Jesus. Amen.